taken into police custody for violating morality laws, 22-year-old Mahsa Amini became the spark of a movement that has taken hold of Iran.
It's been several weeks of sometimes violent street demonstrations in Iran. Dozens of protesters have died. Some have killed security forces.
What makes the current protests in Iran and elsewhere different from those that came before?
Just the pure innocence of a 22-year-old Mahsa Amini dying while in the custody of morality police revealed the real cruelty of the regime to Iranian people everywhere and in the world.
And later in the program, the Biden administration says it's shifting focus from reviving the 2015 nuclear deal to providing support to protesters. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran.
Good morning and welcome to the first edition of our program. I'm Michael Lippin.
And I'm Steve Miller. And we begin this first program by looking at the protests that have filled the streets of Iran. Taken into police custody for violating morality laws, Mahsa Amini became the spark of a movement that has taken hold of Iran and backed by an outpouring of global support. VOA's Arash Arabasadi starts us off.
It's been several weeks of sometimes violent street demonstrations in Iran. Dozens of protesters have died. Some have killed security forces. This all started when 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, a college student with her eyes set on higher education, became the face of a global movement for human rights. Iran's morality police arrested Amini for what they described as immodest attire. 3 days later, in their custody, she was dead. The Islamic Republic released a video it says comes from a police station showing Amini falling to the ground. Officials say the fall triggered a fatal heart attack. Her family says Amini had no known history of heart troubles. That's when protests began, at first without the Islamic Republic crushing them as they have previous demonstrations. More recently, however, Iran resumed its violent suppression of its own people and demonstrations have turned bloody.
دختر جوانی در گذشت خب حادثه تلخی بود دل ما هم سوخت.
Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei called Amini's death a sad incident and said he was heartbroken, but he quickly shifted blame for unrest onto usual foils, the United States and Israel.
We're alarmed and appalled by reports.
The Biden administration says it's alarmed and appalled at what it sees as overreaction by security forces clashing with mostly unarmed protesters. Joining her family, Amini's supporters refute the official cause of death, saying Iran's morality police are to blame. And many Iranians say her death was the spark that lit outraged cries for change. Amini's family, in the meantime, today has more questions than they do answers. Here's her father, Amjad Amini, in an interview with VOA Persian shortly after her death. He says, the authorities never told us the result of the autopsy. They wrote a report the way they wanted it to be. The authorities promised to do a full investigation, but I swear to God that I do not believe a single word they say. I do not trust them at all, and I'm sure they are lying. Whatever they do or say won't bring back my girl to us. Some of the girls who were arrested alongside her told us that Mahsa received a blow to the head with a bat. It is a lie. I swear to God that she did not have any preconditions. Amjad Amini also said his only request is that his daughter's life not be forgotten. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And joining us from the VOA Persian service is reporter Siamak Dehampour. Siamak, I was wondering if you could begin by discussing protests in Iran, because there have been other protest movements in Iran, even just a few years ago. And even going back further to 2009, there was the Green Movement. But what do you see about this particular instance that's really galvanized Iran to protest in these vast and widespread numbers?
Thank you, Steve, for having me. Just the pure innocence of a 22-year-old Mahsa Amini dying while in the custody of morality police revealed the real cruelty of the regime to Iranian people everywhere and in the world. She was an average girl from the city of Saqqez in western Iran. The way government showed zero transparency and no accountability arrested reporters who reported about Mahsa try to silence Mahsa's family and smear them and shut down the internet so the news won't get out. These all were very unusual. This was not about one political action of the government fighting the other. It was about the most basic human rights, about Iranian women, Iranian women's decades of fighting against compulsory hijab. So a true face of cruelty against Iranian women appeared when a woman courageously started protesting in the streets. Men joined them. Unfortunately, again, regime responded by force, by shooting protesters instead of listening to their grievances. And once again, it proved that it could not be reformed. That's why hashtag Mahsa Amini became the number one hashtag on Twitter.
You know, I brought up the Green Movement that took place in 2009 a moment ago, and that's really what these protests have regularly been compared to many times. What do you see as any similarities or differences between the two movements?
Unlike the Green Movement, this is a fight against the entire regime. It's been widespread across the country for more than a month, and it's not limited to the middle class in Tehran. We see youth at the forefront. It's similar in this instance that they are all part of Iranian efforts to give the government a chance to show it can reform itself. But after each cycle of protest, the government has acted uglier than before, as we see in the case of Ebrahim Raisi with horrible human rights record, the current president of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran.
Siamak Dehempour is with VOA's Persian service. Siamak, thank you very much for joining us on this very first episode of Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you, Steve. Good luck with the show.
Iranian authorities have repeatedly disrupted domestic internet services in recent weeks to try to make it harder for anti-government protesters to mobilize and share images of protests with the world. A Washington-based coalition of information and communication technology companies, human rights groups, and investors has been pressing the U.S. government for years to allow more U.S. internet services to be provided to people in Iran in response to such disruptions. Many of those services had been barred under U.S. sanctions. But last month, the Biden administration granted a general license to U.S. tech firms to expand the range of internet services available to Iranians. Jason Pielmeyer is the executive director of the Global Network Initiative Coalition. I asked him what kinds of services internet users in Iran can access under the new U.S. rules.
So there is the question of what services are made available, and in general, the internet is designed in such a way that, you know, these services, whether we're talking about particular apps or particular app stores, are available unless there is some restriction. I mean, the restriction can be on the part of the of a government that is sanctioning, and that's, you know, in this case, the United States, saying to companies that, you know, notwithstanding the general global nature of the internet, we do not want you providing these services in this particular country. And then there's the domestic side, which is, you know, what the Iranian government is trying to allow or restrict people within Iran from being able to access. So what this general license does is make clear that the U.S. government sanctions regime should not prohibit companies from providing these types of services. Generally, we're talking about cloud services, we're talking about apps, we're talking about VPNs, a whole range of services whose primary functionality is communications and sharing of information and data. Now, that doesn't change what the Iranian government on their end may be blocking. And we know from publicly reported data by, you know, groups like Cloudflare and their radar service and the Open Observatory, UNI, and others who are documenting through technical means the blocking that's happening within Iran, that there's a whole lot of filtering and blocking happening. So just because the U.S. government has created this exemption and companies are continuing to offer these services into Iran doesn't mean that the person sitting at their laptop in Tehran or elsewhere is necessarily going to be able to get access. That depends a lot more on what's happening domestically and even regionally, as we've seen there, sort of regional distinctions in terms of what levels of blocking are taking place within the country.
Well, you also raised a good point there about blocking. So if the Iranian government is blocking much of the services that these U.S. tech companies can now offer to Iranians, given the general license issued by the U.S. government, what else can they or the U.S. government do to try to get around that blocking?
Yeah, so some of what was clarified in this license was access to certain tools that are designed specifically to allow circumvention of these censorship measures on the part of the Iranian government. So the kind of most popular and well-known set of tools for that are called virtual private networks, VPNs. But there's a range of different products and offerings that can help in certain instances users get access to these sort of global internet services, notwithstanding the domestic censorship that's been put in place. Again, it's a kind of case by case situation, depending on sort of where you are, what service you're using. We see distinctions not only in Iran but in other countries that are blocking the internet in sort of systematic ways between whether a user is using a mobile device versus a landline, right? And so you may have more ability to access certain services on the landline than on a mobile device. And again, as I mentioned, certain regions of the country may have more access than others, even during certain times of the day, right? There might be, for various reasons, more connectivity or less connectivity, depending on the time of day. So there's a lot of factors that ultimately go into kind of people's ability to access information across borders. I think what the U.S. government is trying to do here is basically remove any obstacles that they may have unintentionally created. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden the floodgates of information have opened, but it does give hopefully users in Iran access to more alternatives and more of these tools that can help them, notwithstanding the blocking that's taking place domestically.
Well, Jason Pillmeyer, Executive Director of the Global Network Initiative, thank you for talking to Flashpoint Iran.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Visit voanews.com and click on the Iran tab at the top of the page for additional updates on Iran throughout the day.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The Biden administration says reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, is no longer its focus due to Iran's refusal to accept a proposed deal after more than a year of indirect negotiations with the United States. Instead, the U.S. State Department says it is focused on providing support to the brave Iranians who have been peacefully protesting against their Islamist rulers. Behnam Ben Talablu is an Iran researcher at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He welcomed the shift in the U.S. position on the JCPOA and newly imposed U.S. sanctions on Iranian officials cracking down on the protests, but told me those moves are not enough to change Iran's behavior.
So long as the quest for the JCPOA, in principle, meaning de facto, remains the U.S. goal, the U.S. will be handicapping itself both morally and strategically vis-a-vis the Islamic Republic. Because even now, in October 2022, the reason there is no deal is because Iran's most important person, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the country's supreme leader, a title meant to be taken rather literally, has decided that he would prefer to humiliate America rather than strike a deal with the U.S. indirectly through the P5+1. And so long as that continues to be the case, the administration can think it's pushing away from the table, but the reality in Tehran would be quite different. So in short, there's great potential for this, but we're going to have to see follow-through from the administration to act on it.
Well, what kind of follow-through are you looking for?
Well, there's two things I briefly mentioned. One is perhaps a potential change in the personnel in the administration. That's always one sign. If you have proponents of the deal, proponents of diplomacy continuing to be in high positions in the Biden administration, it's likely continuing to be a symbol in the eyes of not just America's European partners, but potentially the Iranians that the deal is on the table. or that pressure is not really going to be employed. So that's one. But I think a potentially more salient option is to pivot to a multilateral maximum pressure policy, potentially one that you can have enshrined at the UN level. And that is the snapping back of those older UN Security Council resolutions that would replace 2231 and bring back the multilateral consensus that existed from 2006 to 2010 at the UN. And the administration has the authority, it has the capability to do that. But that authority and capability will lapse by 2025. So I think it's critical now to begin to lay the groundwork for what multilateral pressure on Iran can look like, when already there seems to be a cascade of growing non-nuclear pressure, given the West waking up to the reality of what exactly is going on in Iran.
Well, one other aspect of that reality is Iran's continued advances in enriching uranium. There was a leaked UN Nuclear Agency report that the Reuters news agency picked up on, which talked about more advanced centrifuges being installed at the Natanz nuclear site. How concerning is that development, and what should the U.S. do about it?
So ultimately, this advanced centrifuge hedging that the Islamic Republic has engaged in is one of three main areas that, you know, scholars have called irreversible nuclear knowledge that the regime has gained by not just producing, operating, storing, testing, and ultimately deploying and enriching uranium in these advanced machines. Basically, what centrifuges are, as you know, is they're these metal tubes. You know, some of the older generations, one made of aluminum, but the newer generations, one made of carbon fiber and mirroring steel. And ultimately, they enrich uranium, they purify it, and they can go all the way up to weapons grade. Now, advanced ones break less. They take up less room because they can have less machines have a greater output, and that greater output would be produced in less time. So they're the essential ingredient in any kind of sneak out program by Iran to develop a covert nuclear weapon. And ultimately, this is something that we're going to have to deal with here, because Iran has made leaps and bounds in centrifuge technology, particularly since 2021 and perhaps even since late 2020, depending on that timeline that you're looking at. So this is something the regime has tried to do to both spook Washington as well as to move towards greater understanding of these machines, greater understanding of how they operate under stress, of how fast they can produce, what different breakage rates are. And so Washington needs to use every opportunity that there is an announcement by the IAEA on any kind of advancement or any kind of deploying or testing or enrichment of these machines as an opportunity for pressure. Every time this happens, there should really be another board resolution, a resolution from the Board of Governors, the 35-member Board of Governors at the IAEA, that censures the regime for doing this, and that can essentially potentially lay the groundwork for United Nations Security Council referral, basically, again, escalating the Iranian nuclear file through the UN bureaucracy and moving it up to the UN, so that ultimately at the UNSC, there can potentially be multilateral sanctions on Iran, or potentially have all of this stuff come out in the international community in the limelight and force the likes of Russia and China to have to veto it, to make them own this Iranian slow, steady advancement towards the bomb.
Well, Behnam Bentaleblou, Senior Research Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, thank you for sharing your views with Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
United Against Nuclear Iran, a U.S. bipartisan nonprofit advocacy group known as UANI, says the Biden administration seems to be showing an interest in reducing Iranian oil exports, whose volume rose 30% in 2021 when President Biden took office, compared with 2020. The U.S. unilaterally sanctioned all global trade in Iranian oil in 2018 under former President Donald Trump. Biden administration officials imposed several rounds of sanctions on entities facilitating Iran's oil trade in June, July, and September. I spoke with UANI Chief of Staff Claire Jungman about those designations and asked what she thought of them.
This is a great step. You know, this is something we've been calling for. It's a positive first step, but there's definitely more that can be done. You know, the administration, it has specifically targeted a few vessels, but mostly they're looking at the owners and the operators behind the vessels. Our understanding and belief is that without the sanctions on the vessels specifically, they will just change their ownership. and put it behind a new company. And the vessel will then go about continuing to trade illicit cargo. It's really the sanctions on the vessels that have the impact. And so, for example, you know, a vessel that's not sanctioned may change ownership and somebody else wants to do a ship-to-ship transfer with it. But they don't realize that the vessel's former owner was sanctioned and they go about doing business with it anyways. So there's a number of ways to get around it. But if you actually sanctioned the vessel, that entity interested in doing the ship-to-ship transfer could search the OFAC sanctions list and see vessel X, you know, is sanctioned. Therefore, we're not going to do business with it. So that's just one example of how the sanctions on the vessels definitely have an impact and should be, there should be more of those.
Knowing what you know about Iran's sanctions evasion tactics, how does it, let's say, take advantage of gaps in sanctions or even gaps in sanctions enforcement to ship out its oil?
Sure. So we've seen a number of different tactics that the Iranian regime uses to export its oil. One that's really what we believe is really a significant problem is what we call spoofing of AIS transponders. And just a little bit of background on what this means. Every vessel that's over a certain size has what's called an AIS transponder on it. And this is basically a device that gives off the GPS location of the vessel via satellite. This was used and enabled back in the day to prevent basically crashes, vessels from crashing into each other, or for piracy. You know, somebody could turn off their transponder to hide from piracy activities. So, but now what we're seeing is this is a technology that's really being exploited by the regime. And what we see is instead of turning off these transponders like we used to be able to see happen all the time, and that was a clue that the vessel was probably doing something deceptive if it turned it off in the Persian Gulf. Now what we see is these devices are being spoofed. So it will appear on different ship tracking platforms like the vessel is anchored in Iraqi waters or Omani waters. But in actuality, when Yuani looks at satellite imagery to determine where the vessel is, we're not finding it there. We're finding it in Iranian ports or in ship-to-ship transfers. And so as a result, you know, the vessel can then say, well, we never went to Iran. Look at it. Look at the AIS. We loaded Iraqi oil or we loaded Omani oil. That's not sanctioned. So that's one loophole. And Iran's not the only country that's been using this now. We're seeing Venezuela do it as well. And it wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing Russia do it once the sanctions on Russian oil kick in December.
So just to finish up here, what would you say is a solution to this problem of some tankers using this AIS spoofing method to make up locations where these tankers are supposedly at?
I think definitely the maritime industry as a whole needs to do more robust due diligence into cracking down on this problem. You know, Yuani informs a lot of those within the industry of this type of activity. And I think they're a little bit behind the ball and behind the game on figuring out a way to track this type of activity. And then I also think, again, going back to sanctions on the vessels themselves, not all of the vessels that are engaging in this type of activity are sanctioned. It's the cargo on them that's sanctioned. So if the administration sanctions these vessels, then, you know, maybe a specific port won't allow that vessel to discharge its oil there, or maybe a flag state won't be able to provide a registration for the vessel, which the vessels need in order to be able to sail the seas. Or maybe the vessel won't be able to get insurance coverage. And all of that hampers Iran's ability to transport its oil, sell its oil, and then receive revenue from it.
Well, thank you very much, Claire Jungman, for that analysis. Claire Jungman is Chief of Staff and a Tanker Tracker at United Against Nuclear Iran. Thank you for joining Flashpoint Iran today.
That brings us to the end of today's program. There's more VOA coverage of Iran 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm Michael Lippin. On behalf of Steve Miller and the Flashpoint Iran team, thank you for listening to the first edition of our program, and we hope you'll join us again next week.